The very last day of Tekkit. Everyone still have a little energy? Yeah. Excellent. Wow, that was actually more energy than I got yesterday when I asked a similar question. So, T-SQL has not exactly been the most dynamic of languages when it comes to new features and new abilities and things like that. Today's talk, if you're expecting a what's new in SQL Server 2014 T-SQL talk, I will give it to you in the next 5 seconds, or 4 seconds, probably nothing. Today we're going to talk about SQL Server 2012. I find that's a good topic, because a lot of people still are not really up to speed on what happened in SQL Server 2012, which is a huge upgrade to the T-SQL language that lets us do a lot more things a lot easier than was possible before, sometimes with higher performance than was possible before. And so today's focus is really on getting back to our basics. What is our basic goal as a database person? It's to solve business problems and to quickly and hopefully somewhat simply solve those business problems. And that's really the goal here today, is to get you a little bit better at quickly and easily writing queries that help your end users do whatever it is that they need to do. So, quick bit about me. My name is Adam Mechanic. I live in Boston, Massachusetts, where I work as a SQL Server architect and developer and performance tuner and whatever needs to be done, primarily focusing on the financial services industry. I've written a number of books and for magazines and websites and things like that. Hopefully you've read some of my stuff. Speak at a lot of these events, and I have a website, sqlblog.com, where I just hit submit on the demos for both today and yesterday prior to this mic turning on. It might not have hit the front page quite yet due to our caching, but it should be there sometime in the next 15 minutes or so. So if you want the demos, go to sqlblog.com. It should be the top post on the site until someone else posts something. If you want to contact me, my email address and Twitter are at the bottom of the screen. Always love chatting with people on interesting topics. No spam, please. No Trojan horses of any kind. If you would, I'd really appreciate it. And that's it. Let's talk about kind of what we're going to do and how we're going to spend our time today. I'm going to keep things very simple. We're going to start with some background information. I know how much you guys love seeing speakers blab on and on in PowerPoints. So we're going to go from the background to lots of demos, and that's it. Perfect. This slide looked much better with four things than two things, so I had to do something there. You know, what can I do? Anyway, let's just quickly go through some background and then jump into demos. And I mean, that's where the power is, right? This is a T-SQL talk. This isn't a PowerPoint talk. So the main thing that I want you to get out of this talk is an understanding of what windowing is and what framing is. So the way that I like to imagine this is, if you're on a train and each person on the train, let's say, has access to a window on the train. These are called windowing functions, so this is a good metaphor. Each person has access to a window, and as you're driving by, let's say, a city, each person will see a different view of the city, but eventually everyone will see all of the city. So let's imagine that our city is data. And let's imagine that the person sitting in the front window can see at this point. So the train's going to drive by the entire city. So this is your query, effectively, scanning all the rows of the table. And this person in the front window has a given frame of reference. And they can see this piece of the data right when the train's here. And the person in the next window can see this piece of the data. Maybe the data is overlapping between the two frames. Maybe it's not. And the idea is that with these features that we're going to discuss today, you can define as many of these frames as you need in whatever ways that you need to see the data, and you can logically traverse the rows in your table or in your set of tables that you're joining together or whatever, in whatever way you need, very, very flexibly. And that's the power of these features. So let's go through a slightly more data-oriented example. And so here's some data, and this data is ordered by product ID and transaction date. Now, when we're working with these features, all of our data is always assumed to be ordered by something. And we're always going to look at the data in some specific order. So here we are ordered by product ID and transaction date. And logically, we begin from the top row, and we begin iterating down the set. And let's say that our window frames are just are described using a syntax similar to this. This says we want all the rows between one preceding and current row. Okay? And that means we want one row before the row that we're on, and we want the current row. And we want to see them both in the same frame. So when we're on the first row, there is no prior row yet, but we still get a window frame. That's important to keep in mind. Our window frames describe the maximum amount of data that we can see, but they don't describe the minimum amount. And the minimum amount at any given time will always be one row, or maybe it'll be no rows. For example, I could describe a window frame between two preceding and one preceding, in which case my window frame wouldn't see any rows, and I would just get back a null in this case. Now, for this example, my frame returns one row here, and I could, in my query, have another frame running simultaneously, which is between three preceding and two following. So frames can look both backward and forward in your data. They can do either. They can do both at the same time. Very, very flexible, and that's kind of the power of this feature. So as we move down another row, you can see that the frames begin widening because we had data at the beginning, or we had a frame at the beginning which was not fully encompassing. So you'll see both frames will widen and widen, and then the frame on top begins moving down as we continue iterating. The frame on the bottom keeps widening a little bit, and then it begins moving down as well. And that's logically what's going to happen as we go through our query. And logically, at each point, we have access to all the data in the frame and can do stuff with it. We can aggregate it or ask questions about it and so on and so forth. Now, that's just framing. There's also, on top of framing, the ability to do partitioning. Now, partitioning is effectively the same as framing, but it adds a reset point to the frame along the way. So here we're partitioning by product ID and then ordering by the transaction date. So it's going to be the same thing, effectively. We're going to start on the top row. We're going to iterate down. But our frames, when we hit a new product ID, will reset. It'll be as though we've started the process over again. So we're going to go down, and we're on product ID 13360. And we're going down. And now our frame, oh, we're not quite there yet. And now once we hit the next row, you're going to see that the frames are going to jump down into product 59335. And so it's basically the same as before, except we have many reset points in the frame instead of a single reset point. And again, the important thing to remember is that at every one of these reset points, the size of your frame, if you have prior rows that you're looking at, is going to drop. And this is important if you're doing things like, for example, a common business requirement is to frame data over the last 18 months rolling or past quarter rolling or something like that. And it's really important to remember that when you hit the top of the frame, you're no longer 18 months back. And you have to decide, from a business perspective, how you want to handle that situation. Do you want to include that? Do you want to throw it out? Do you want to send back a special note with those rows? You have to do something. Better to do something than to do nothing is kind of the point. So just keep that in mind. That's framing. And what can you do with these frames? Well, back in SQL Server 2005, they added the initial versions of stuff you could do with these, which are row numbers, ranks, dense ranks. Hopefully you've all had a chance to familiarize yourself with at least some of that. We're not going to talk about that stuff too much today, just a little bit. In SQL Server 2012, started adding some more interesting functions. Analytic functions for offset purposes, lag and lead. These allow us to ask for specific rows, either backward in the case of lag, or forward in the case of lead, and get specific values from those rows. So for example, if I'm on a given row, I can say, what was my value 3 rows back? That's a lag. Or I can say, what is my value 10 rows forward? That's a lead. And then I can use that to do interesting analytics, hopefully. Another kind of analytic function is a framed analytic function. What's the first value in my set, or what's the last value in my set, where my set is my window frame? So looking back 18 months, in my window frame, what's the first value back there, and how does that compare to my value today? Maybe I could do some delta calculation or something like that. Now, obviously, I can achieve the same thing with lag and lead if I know that I have exactly 18 rows back. But these together, we'll see some examples, give us a lot of flexibility. And you can do things with first value and last value that you can't do easily with lag and lead, and the other way around. Another set are aggregates. Sum, average, count, min, max. All of these things I'm sure you're intimately familiar with. You can apply window frames to these, and you can accomplish running and moving calculations. So for example, you can apply a window function to sum, and you can get a running sum across the frame. You can apply a frame to average, and you can get a moving average. That's our 18-month, for example, moving average calculation. So these things become very, very powerful. Now, as we're going through the examples, we're going to see a lot of query plans. I'm going to show you what these things look like and how they work in the query processor. It's important to understand these if you care a little bit about performance. So here are some of the iterators we're going to see. First of all, the segment iterator. This is the iterator that's responsible for taking the partitions and telling downstream iterators when they hit a new partition so they can reset. That's the segment iterator. Another one is sequence project. Sequence project produces numbers, either row numbers, ranks, or dense ranks. As it turns out, all of these windowing functions, whether they're row numbers, ranks, or dense ranks, or something else, are all based on segments and sequence projects. Internally, they use these row numbers to help do their work and figure out where they are in the frame. Added in SQL Server 2012 was a new kind of spool operator called a window spool. And the window spool enables the query processor to take a bunch of rows, temporarily store them, calculate a value that needs to be applied across all the rows, apply that value, and then output all the rows in one shot. That's a really interesting enhancement. It allows SQL Server to be much more efficient with certain query patterns. We'll see that in a bit. Finally, sort. Nothing new here, but as I mentioned before, every single one of these functions requires ordered input. So you're going to start seeing a lot more sorts in your query plans. This is very important to keep in mind. Sort is extremely expensive, not just in SQL Server, but anywhere that you need to sort data. It's an expensive, expensive thing. So if you care about performance, you're going to want to look for these sort iterators and try to eliminate or decrease them by either using indexing or maybe different query patterns. We'll talk about that toward the end. With that, we're done with the deck. Let's jump into some demos. Are there any questions before I do that? Okay. So I think I'm over here. And I have to log in. Okay. So let's go to AdventureWorks. And let's start with running sum. So prior to SQL Server 2012, if you wanted to get a running sum, this was how you had to do it. You had to start with a table. We're going to do a sum of quantity, and we're going to basically group by all the rows in the table and order by transaction ID. And prior to SQL Server 2012, if I wanted to calculate this kind of running sum, I would start with my table, and then I would join it to itself. So here I'm saying, give me all the rows from production.transaction history, join it to production transaction history, and we'll call the first one TH, we'll call the second one TH1, and I want all of the TH1 rows, I want their transaction IDs to be less than the TH transaction IDs. So for transaction ID 1, I'm going to get one row, right? One row back in TH1. And for transaction ID 2, I'm going to get rows 2 and 1. And transaction ID 3, I'm going to get 3, 2, and 1, and so on and so forth. And eventually, I'm going to get all the rows, and it's going to come back. Now, let me turn on the actual query plan here. And I'm going to run this, and what we're going to see is it's not the fastest thing in the world. I didn't expect it to be quite this slow, to be honest. Well, I don't know how much time I'll give it. I thought it was going to run a little bit faster than that. I mean, it's making a good demo because you're going to see that the new way is much faster, but God, that's ridiculous. Okay, let's just hit stop. We don't need to see the output. Trust me, it produces a running sum. Let's look at the query plan, however. And why is it so slow? Well, It's so slow because this is how it's implemented. So for each row, we're going to scan transaction history. And for each row, we're going to go out and grab all the prior rows from transaction history so that we can sum them up. So for row one, we only have one row, so that's no big deal. For row two, we only have two rows, that's no big deal. For row 1,000,000, now we have to get 1,000,000 rows. Now that starts being a big deal. And as a matter of fact, mathematically, we're going to need to process, if we have n rows, we're going to need n squared divided by 2 total rows in that set. That's going to be a big number of rows. That doesn't scale very nicely. So what we can do in SQL Server 2012 and beyond instead is this, the new way. So this says the same thing as that query did, but it does it a little bit differently. So this says, give me a sum of quantity and run that sum in a frame that's not bounded, ordered by transaction ID. And when I run this, instead of hitting stop after 25 seconds, I get the data back instantly. And the reason is that all it has to do is a forward scan of the data. Let's look at the execution plan. Notice parallelism is gone. SQL Server introduces parallel iterators when the cost of the query plan increases, but this is a very simple plan. It scans the data in order, because I'm doing it by transaction ID, so that's what the clustered index happens to be. It goes ahead and segments the data. Even though I don't have a partition by, it still segments it, which always returns the same result every time. Then it goes into this new window spool iterator, which I mentioned before. And again, what the window spool does is it keeps track of the data. Now, given this scenario, the window spool at any given time has only one row in the spool. It's just the sum at that point. So SQL Server scans the table, and for each row, calculates a sum, tosses it on the row, outputs it. Good stuff, good stuff. Now, that's just a basic running sum, but there's a lot more functionality here. There's a lot of expressiveness that we can add. For example, if instead of just calculating a single running sum over the entire set, we want to do it per product, all we have to do, and again, this is where it gets really easy to write complex analytic business queries, all we have to do is partition by. So this is the same thing as before, but now run it per product ID. And it runs in about the same amount of time with a slightly similar query plan. Now we had to introduce a sort. Why do we have to introduce a sort? Because the data always has to be ordered by whatever we're partitioned on and whatever we're ordered on. So that's PO. Just remember P, partitioning, O, ordering. Later, I'll tell you two other letters that you'll want to apply to that acronym. So these are the P and the O, partitioning and ordering. And our sort, as we can see, is on, whoa, that's a big pink ball. Let's make it smaller and green. How about that? That's prettier, right? OK. So it's on our product ID and our transaction ID. And the reason we got the sort on that is because I partitioned on product ID, and I ordered by transaction ID. And guess what? I don't have an index on product ID and transaction ID. So that's that. Now, as I mentioned before, we can have multiple simultaneous frames, as many as we want in our query. And that's where the expressiveness gets really nice. So if I need both a sum partitioned by product ID and ordered by transaction ID, not a problem. I can put as many as I want. If I want multiple things, sums and averages and so on and so forth, all ordered the same way, all partitioned the same way, not a problem. I will, somewhere, none of this is free, so I will have to pay a price somewhere. If I hit F5 here, we can see the query's slightly slower than before. It's because it had to do all of the work. I still got my sort for, let's see, what did it do first? Let's go all the way over. So what SQL Server decided to do in this plan, it decided to sort on product ID and transaction ID first, calculate that, and then it decided to resort on transaction ID. Now this is interesting. Let's take this. Now remember you were told, I bet, that the order of stuff in your query doesn't matter? Like the order of columns in your select list doesn't matter, and the order of predicates in your where clause doesn't matter? Remember you were told that? I bet you were. Let's find out if it matters here. Actually, I'm not sure, but I believe it does. So remember we had two sorts before. I just reordered things. And
see what happens. Ah, yes,
I was right. Now, the first thing it's going to do, notice there's not a sort, is calculate the transaction ID order, and then it's going to sort the data on product ID and transaction ID, calculate that data. So I've gone from two sorts down to one sort by reordering. That's not a necessarily great user experience, but it's something to keep in mind. If you want to make your queries a little faster, pay attention to the query plans when you're using this stuff, and order it in whatever order makes sense based on what indexes you have in your table, or how you think the best processing order is going to be. All right? Any questions on that? Cool. Let's move on then. And let's talk about range mode versus rows mode. So I've kind of been brushing over the window frame so far. Notice these queries have no window frame defined. As I mentioned before, the window frame is expressed as like rows between X and Y. Well, there's actually two modes. There's one called range mode and one called rows mode. What we're going to see is that most of the time you want something called rows mode, but the default is something else, something called range mode. And let me change this. Instead of using the transaction ID, I'm going to order instead by the transaction type. We're going to see something very interesting in the output. So let's let me go up here and just rerun the query and just prove that this actually works. I don't know if we looked at the output. Here's our running sum. So I wasn't lying. That is indeed a running sum. And we get a different value for every row. Okay? And if we change it to transaction type, now we expect still a running sum, right? But just ordered a different way. Well, something weird happens. Does that look like a running sum? No, it doesn't. It looks like we're getting the same value for each transaction type. Now let's scroll down a bit. Where do the P's end? There it is. As soon as the P's end, there we go. Notice we get an increase when we hit S, and then let's go down to the bottom of S. Come on, S. And we hit W. I actually don't know what these are. Purchase, sale, what's W? Well, anyway, notice that W is higher than S, and so on and so forth. And the reason for this is that the default window frame is something called range mode, where instead of looking at a number of rows in the partition frame, it looks at values in the partition frame. So what I'm saying here implicitly is order by transaction type. Anytime you see the same transaction type, apply the same value until you hit a new transaction type, then apply the sum of the prior transaction type plus everything from the new transaction type, and so on and so forth. That's range mode. It's values based. Well, most of us as database people actually don't think in terms of values. We think in terms of rows. So I'm not sure that this makes sense. So this is the default window frame. It's a range unbounded proceeding, which says find all of the values prior to the value of the row that we're on. And if they match, keep going on the same value. And as soon as we find a new one, apply the new value. I don't know if that makes sense for most queries. I think what makes more sense is a row-based mode. If you want to use the range-based mode, what you need to do is use a tiebreaker. So the reason that I got a running sum in the first place was that I had transaction ID, which is unique for every row. So my range was always changing. My value was always changing, and it wasn't matching. In this query, transaction type doesn't change as often. So my value doesn't change as often. So if you want to use range mode, you have to remember, unless that's really what you're after, you have to remember to always use a tiebreaker. When I do this and break the tie using the transaction ID, now I get back to the running sum I'm after. But maybe that's not really what I want to do. Maybe I don't want to hack range mode to use a tiebreaker. Maybe what I instead want to do is a rows-based methodology. And so if I change this from range unbounded proceeding to rows unbounded proceeding, still ordered by transaction type, now it changes all the logic. Instead of looking for values it's going to look for rows. Instead of calculating the sum one value at a time, it's going to calculate it one row at a time. And now when I run this query, we're going to get back the running sum that we're after. No tiebreaker needed, because we're in a row-based methodology. And rows mode is really nice. It has some really, aside from the fact that it actually works the way we expect it to work, which is, you know, a nice bonus, aside from that, it has some very nice qualities, like because it's a rows-based methodology and not a values-based methodology, it doesn't have to remember as much along the way. It tends to be faster. See some examples of that. So once we're in rows mode, now range mode doesn't really expose a lot of window framing options. You can have an unbounded preceding or an unbounded following range, and that's really about it. That's all you can do with range mode. Now with rows mode, now we can start asking for specific rows. Now the reason you can't do that with range mode, you actually can in the ANSI standard where all this stuff is defined, you can actually apply filters in range mode, but they didn't implement that in SQL Server yet. So for now, we just have a simple range mode, but for rows mode, we can actually ask for the specific rows that we're after. So here, I can say I want a moving sum. It's going to be a running moving sum ordered by transaction type, and I want only the rows between 10 rows preceding and the current row. So once we get to row 11, we're going to start seeing movement through the set. Let's go ahead and run that. And this is where things get really, really flexible. So for this row, we're just getting this row's value. For this row, we're getting the prior 2. For this row, we're getting the prior 3. Once I get down here to row 10, I get the prior 10. And for row 11, we're actually going to do like that many rows. And then we're going to see that value 33 is going to stick, not because it's applying the same value along the way, but because all these rows have a value of 3. So you can see that the sum is moving along with the rows. And maybe that's where we can apply that 18-month logic, last quarter logic, last 6 months, whatever you want to move along your data. And this is where the window frames become really, really powerful. I can have, again, as many window frames as I want, as few as I want, as many different ways as I want to chop this up and configure it. So very good stuff. How about a forward-looking window frame? That's no problem either. So now I'm saying, give me a sum, and include in that sum all the rows between 10 back and 10 forward. So how many total rows in my window frame? Sorry? 21? Good. I was waiting for someone to say 20. Because that's like what, you know, you have to, the point is you have to always remember the current row. The current row is always included in this particular window frame. So it's just kind of one of those things that people don't think completely through before jumping to the gut conclusion. So this, again, runs the same way, except it looks both forward and backward. And again, it runs very efficiently. In this case, we do get our one sort on the same thing. But thanks to notice we have all kinds of segments and sequence projects in the plan. But pretty much everything is handled in here in this really, really efficient window spool operator. So it's really efficient, good stuff. So that's that. Now let's take a look at rows mode versus range mode. I'm going to turn on time statistics and I/O statistics. And these queries, now here's range mode with a broken tie, okay? And here's rows mode, also with a broken tie, but we wouldn't necessarily need to break the tie, but just making the queries absolutely identical, right? These queries will give the completely identical output. They're logically the same query. And let's look at the query plans. And notice that the cost, the subtree cost of this one is like 3.91, and the subtree cost of the second one is like 3.92. The cost of the second one is actually higher than the cost of the first one. And the query plans are almost 100% identical. Each of the query plans has a sort, a little parallelism operator. The only difference actually between them is that this one has an extra segment operator right there. That's the only difference between these plans. Almost identical. Well, let's see if they really are identical. I'm going to run them. Now, the output is identical. What we care about here is performance. So here's the first one. This one's the one that uses the range mode. I'm going to go here. We're going to look at our data. And it took 1,300 milliseconds of CPU time And notice we had 683,000 logical reads against this work table. And what is this work table? This work table is where range mode stores all of its values so that it can match up those values as it ingests more and more rows. Now let's go and run the rows one, which again has identical output. That one, instead of taking 1,300 milliseconds, took 327 milliseconds and zero logical reads on the work table. Work table's still there, just in case, but it's not even used. So, yeah. Hopefully you can see when you're working with these things, when you're working with window frames, unless you really, really need that range mode, flip it into rows mode. Unfortunately, range mode is the default, so you have to do this work. SQL Server won't do this work for you. All right? So that's that. Let's take one other look in. And here we're going to use rows mode, and we're going to ask for the prior 9,998 rows. And this is just one of those thresholds you need to be aware of. I'm going to run this. And we'll go over again, and we'll look at CPU and work table. Notice once again, we have zero logical reads on our work table, and we have about 563 milliseconds of CPU time that we're consuming. Now I'm going to flip it from 9,998 to 9,999 rows. And when I run that, uh-oh, 877,000 reads on the work table and 1,600 milliseconds of CPU time. Why did that happen? Well, there's an arbitrary threshold that's built into SQL Server. It's hard-coded into SQL Server that as soon as rows mode hits a case where there are 10,000 rows in the frame, and in this case there's 10,000 rows because 9,999 plus the current row, as soon as there's 10,000 rows in that frame, it starts spilling out to disk so that it doesn't use excessive memory. Unfortunately, there's nothing you can do about this. It's just something to keep in mind. Now, if you think about it, 10,000 rows, it's a huge number of rows. Think about how many years, if you were doing, like, let's say, daily granularity on your data, that's like a lot of years worth of data. Isn't that something like 30 years? So that's a really large number. If you're doing that, I don't know. You should think about carefully what you're doing and why you need to do that. But it's just something to keep in mind. This will really, really slow down your plans if you do increase that window frame a little bit too much. Any questions or anything I can clarify at this point before we move on? Okay. So next, let's jump over. And we talked about moving sums a little bit. And let's discuss the first value and last value functions. So I'm going to go into AdventureWorks. And we'll start once again with the really old way. This is like the pre-SQL Server 2005 way of finding the last row for each month. Now, maybe we have data, you know, we have daily data, let's say, and what we want to find is the value for the last business day of the month. So it's not necessarily going to be the last calendar day of the month. So what we really need to go through is month over month over month. We need to find out what the last day is, grab that value, and so on. So here's how we had to do it back in, like, SQL Server 2000. I'm grabbing rows from production.transactionHistory. I'm cheating because I'm using a SQL Server 2012 function in this query to show the old way. So ignore that. I'm using this EO month function. EO month is super handy. EO stands for end of. So this function returns, actually let's just run it. So select get date, EO month, get date, and what it returns is the last day of the month. Very handy function. I kind of scoffed when they put this in the product, and now I'm using it everywhere. Like everywhere I'm doing date logic, it's so useful, so much easier than in the prior ways of doing things. But anyway, so what I've done is I'm calculating the end of month for the transaction day. I'm calling that transaction month. I'm grabbing the max transaction date, so the actual maximum day for which we had business. And I'm grouping by transaction ID and product ID. So I want the last date of each month per transaction ID and product ID. And I take that in a derived table. And then I have to join it out to the production.transactionHistory again, and I join on the product ID and the transaction, the last transaction date and the transaction ID. and then I have to order it, and you know, you have to do all this work basically. Let's do query, include actual execution plan. And basically you have to do all this work in order to get that information. You can see we have, you know, a hash match plan and has to go through, touch the table twice, has to do a sort on behalf of our order by. I mean, that makes sense, but if we switch over to row number, we can solve this same problem. Now again, row number was introduced in SQL Server 2005, and if we want to do the same thing with row number, it becomes quite simple. What we do is, again, we need to calculate the transaction month so that we have something off of which to pivot, off of which to work. So we calculate our transaction month, and then we run a row number, and for each transaction month and product ID, we reset the numbering, and we start numbering by transaction date descending. Now the first day in each set will have a row number of 1, second day will have a row number 2, third day will have a row number 3, and so on, starting at the end of the month and going backward. So if I want the last day of each month, all I have to do is filter is last row equals 1. And now I get the last day of each month. And that's really, really quite handy. So row number gives me a much cleaner, nicer, straighter, and more efficient way to solve these kinds of problems. And it becomes very, very simple. Now that's been there since SQL Server 2005. Let's talk about what's in SQL Server 2012. What if I want to add more value to this? What if I want the last day of the month, but I also want the value as of the first day of the month, so I can do some kind of comparative delta logic? I can't really do that with row number, at least not easily. But using what's in SQL Server 2012, I can very easily do it. So what I can do is use the first value function. And so here we're going to calculate the same exact row number as before, but I'm going to add additional value to it. I'm going to ask for the first value of the transaction date, and I'm going to partition that by the transaction month and product ID. I'm going to order it by the transaction date, same exact frame used inside of my row number, as a matter of fact. So I'm going to ask for the first value for the date. That's my first business day of the month. I'm going to ask for the first value for my cost. That's the first transaction, how much that went for of the month. And now I can pull that all back if I want, and I can do whatever I need to in my report with that data. So here's my first date, my first cost, here's my last date, my last cost. They happen to be the same here, but just to prove that it actually works, I can scroll down and eventually, well, the dates are different. Ah, so here's one where, for example, it actually changed. Adventure works, what are you gonna do? But I'm going to go over to my execution plan, and what we can see is this is really pretty cool. We had to have a couple of different sorts. SQL Server went ahead and sorted on product ID and transaction date to calculate this initial frame, and then went into the segment and sequence project operators, calculated the first values in there, and then it only needed one more sort in order to calculate our row number and filter it. So again, fairly efficient. Could be made slightly more efficient if I had maybe an index that could be used, but it's pretty good stuff, and it can reuse the window frames for as many functions as I want to add, as many first values, last values, and so on and so forth, as long as they have the same window frame. So that's that. Now let's talk about last value a little bit. Now first value gives us the first value in the frame, and last value gives us the last value in the frame, right? So here I'm going to ask for rows off production.product, just because it's something simple to query. I'm going to ask for the name. I'm going to ask for the first name ordered by product ID, and I'm going to ask for the last name ordered by product ID. Let's see what happens. All right, so here's my name. And the first name is adjustable race, okay? And it's always adjustable race, right? Because if I order by product ID with no partitioning, adjustable race is always gonna be the first row. And look at the last name. That doesn't make any sense. How can the last name change row over row over row? Any ideas? Sorry? It's the current name. Why is it the current name? Sorry? There's no previous one. Well, we don't actually want a previous one. We want a following one. right? We want, for last value, we want to look forward. This is something important to keep in mind. This is why I got into, this is why I was so serious about showing you the default window frames in the prior demos. The default window frame for first value and for all of these functions is range unbounded preceding. But for the last value, do we need preceding rows? No, we need following rows. We need rows ahead of us. But the default window frame is still range unbounded preceding. So we're getting the last value looking back, which is kind of weird. This thing, I've seen tons and tons and tons of forum posts. Like, why is last value broken? Well, it's not broken. It's just doing what the default says that it should do. The default maybe is a little bit less than ideal. So if you actually want a last value, you don't want to just put it in like this. What you want is to set a proper window frame. So here we're saying last value ordered by product ID rows between the current row and unbounded following. Now it's going to look forward to calculate that last value, and we're going to get exactly what we're after. Another option, if you'd rather, I mean, what is a last value? Well, a last value is nothing more than a first value facing the other direction. So if we have a first value ordered by product ID descending, that's the same as the last value ordered by product ID. And now we can just use the default window frame because it's looking backward. So if you want that last value, you have two options, depending on the level of complexity you're going to want to take. I mean, some people, I think, find this, and maybe it's a readability question. Some people might find this slightly easier to read or more intuitive, especially business users, than when you start throwing this thing in there. I've seen, you know, their eyes are going to glaze over a little bit. You know, it might be good for you, maybe not so good for them. So depending on the level of performance you're after and level of readability, you can decide which of these you want. Anything I can clarify on that? What's the performance difference? See, this one is going to perform better. So if I turn on, we'll just do IO statistics. Yeah, we'll just do IO. If I go here, we're going to see we get 3,045 reads from the window frame. That's the rows mode. If I go for this one, we are going to get 6,000 reads from the window frame. Now, notice we got reads from the window frame in both cases because the first value function, I didn't override the window frame. So that's using range mode in both cases. So in the first one, we get just the 3,000 from the first value. In the second one, we get 3,000 as well from the last value. So if you care about performance and you're willing to take that additional kind of eyes glazing over complexity hit, that's what you can do. All right? So let's go on. And let's talk about the lag and lead functions. These are the most powerful functions, I think, that have been added. And these are the ones that let you look back and forward an arbitrary number of rows each time you use them. So the simplest and the most obvious business purpose for these is a period over period moving delta. And this is really, really useful stuff. I've used this a huge number of times, actually, since this has been released. So for this one, I'm going to start by preparing my data. And I'm going to sum the actual cost, and I'm going to put the data into a monthly granularity. So I'm calculating the last day of the month per product. I'm summing the actual cost, because I want to know what my, if I just go back like one row, like let's say I have daily data, and I go back one row, I guess that's useful. I could have day over day. If I have multiple rows per day, though, and I just go back one row, what am I doing? It's kind of meaningless. It's like last transaction over last transaction, unless you're doing stock market stuff, with like bids and asks and trying to calculate spreads, intraday calculation is generally not effectively useful. So here, what we want to do is establish, before we do anything else, our granularity. And our granularity here is month. And what I want to calculate is a month over month delta. So I'm going to take the lag. Again, the default is to look back one row. I'm going to take the lag of the total cost per product ordered by transaction month. For each row, I'm going to get one row prior. And if I want to calculate my delta, I'm going to take the total cost, subtract that same thing. And this is just an example of where you can use these things all over the place in your select list. You can put them into an expression. You can put them into a case expression. You can nest them a bit. So you can go fairly complex with these things. You can use them in either the select list or the order by clause. Unfortunately, you cannot use them in the where clause. If you want to use them in the where clause, you have to define a derived table and then filter on the outside of that. But that's fine here. We're going to run this. And what we see is that for the first row, we didn't have a prior row. So we got back a null. And that's fine. I mean, again, we want to maybe do something a little more intelligent with that, or maybe not. Maybe we just want to leave it. For the second row, we got back this value. And here's our delta. For the third row, we get back that value. And for the fourth row, we get back that value, and so on and so forth. And so right away, you can see it's very easy to look backward, a single row at a time, a single level of granularity at a time, which is nice. Now, here's some other options we have. Now, I just use the default. The default is just lag. And what you're going to see is that lag has no rows mode or range mode window frame. And the reason is it doesn't really make sense. It's always based on a number of rows. The default is one row. You can go more rows back if you want. So it doesn't have a window frame that's specified in the same way. Instead, you specify it as optional arguments into the lag function. And here are the optional arguments. So here's the total cost again. Here's the number of rows to look back, which is, again, effectively its window frame. They don't call it a window frame, but that's what it is. And here's a really cool option. If you have no value in the frame looking back, so if we don't have a value two rows back, by default, we're going to get a null. But what if it really was a null in some case? How would we differentiate between that real null and the null because we didn't have anything? So one of the default options that's really powerful is a default value to put in place when we don't have a real value. So you could set that, for example, in this case, to the minimum integer value or something like that. So you have some placeholder that you know won't really appear in your data, but it will tell you what the real situation is. Missing value token, really good stuff. So I'm going to put that in place. And now what we see is for the first two, now we're looking back two rows. So for the first two rows, instead of getting those nulls, we get our negative 10, what is that? It's 100,000. And then we start getting our actual values. So that gets us a little bit more power. But we still have more after this. Now here's a question for you. Is it really the last month that we're looking at? Let me go ahead and run. Actually, let's just go ahead and look at this again. Let me scroll down to product 366, which I happen to know. And 366 has a gap. What's going on here? Oh, we're looking back two rows. Okay, so 366. Let me go back up here. Let's go back here. And what we want is a month over month lag, right? Let's go down to 366 here. When I went to the two rows, it changed things. 366 has this nice gap. There we go. Now notice that we have a gap on between October and December. We didn't have anything in November. So our data isn't really month over month, is it? It's row over row. And that's an important thing to keep in mind when you're doing business reports. Unless you can absolutely assume or absolutely guarantee that your data has no gaps, no holes, you're not really doing what you think you're doing. I mean, it's nice to think, okay, I have monthly granularity. If I go back one row, it's 1 month. But that's not always the case. So what we need to do, if we want to be complete with our solutions, is put a little validation in place. Make sure that we don't introduce data anomalies. So let's go back and just check out how to do that. It's very easy. What we're going to do is we're going to introduce a second lag. So we have the total cost for last month, but then I'm also going to lag over the transaction month itself. I'm going to introduce that as a row called last month. And what I'm going to do is throw out, or I'm going to only include rows where there's exactly 1 month between the last month and the transaction month. So I'm going to throw out all the garbage. Now, again, you might not want to throw it out. You might want to include a, you know, a token or a message or a note or something. But the important thing here as I mentioned before, is to do something and not just to do nothing. So here when I run this, it's going to basically be the same as before, except for 366. We are going to say goodbye to December of that year. Goodbye, December. Nothing happened in December, or at least nothing that we could compare to November. So we don't want that in our report. All right? So that's validation. Now, another thing I want to show you is date packing. This is a process whereby we take consecutive days. Now, let's go ahead and run this. So here's product ID, end of month. I'm going to prepare the data in the same way. I'm going to run this. And what we can see is that for, let me just order it. And what if I want to know on which consecutive ranges we had activity for my products? So for product ID 1, I had activity from September and October and November and December and January and February and March and April. I had all these rows, right? And they're all consecutive rows. Maybe it's easier for me to ingest into my application one row, which would be September. And if they're all consecutive, all the way to August. And then if I have a gap, maybe a second row would show up. And if I have another gap, maybe a third row would show up, and so on and so forth. That's known as date packing. And one of the examples where these functions get very useful is with date packing. So here I'm preparing my data the same way. And what I'm going to do is calculate a value. I'm going to take a month, the difference in months between last month and this month. And if it's 1, I'm going to put out a 0. And if it's not 1, then I'm going to put a 1 in. And I'm going to call that isStart. And if you think about it, if there is more than 1 month between last month, or the month on the last row, and this month, then that's the start of a new range. That's why I'm going to put that 1 there. And if there's exactly 1 month, then that's not the start of a new range, which is why I'm going to put a 0 there. So when I run this, for that first row, that's a start. After that, I don't have any more starts for this particular product. For the first row of 3, that's a start. I don't have any more starts. Let's scroll down to, let's go to our 366 again. These didn't come out in order, did they? How annoying. Well, you'll trust me. Now I'm going to take that. I'm going to take that is start, and I'm going to sum it. And I'm going to sum, partitioned by product ID, and ordered by transaction ID. So now when we hit the first is start, where it's 1, I'm going to get a 1, and then I'm going to hit the zeros. So it's going to be 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. If I have another is start, then I'm going to start getting 2s. 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2. If I hit another is start, I'm going to start getting 3s and so on. And now I have groups of data. And what can I do if I have groups? I call it interval group. I can take the min transaction month per group. That's my start date. I can take the max. That's my end date. I can take the sum of the activity that occurred during that range. That's my total cost. And my group by is on product ID and interval group. So now, for each group, I get my ranges, I get my sums. And when I run this, good things happen. And I get a lot fewer rows with a lot, hopefully, more insight. Make sense? All right. Anything I can clarify on that technique? I'm sorry? 366, absolutely. I love that product. I don't even know what it is. So here's our 366. So you can see we don't have we had a gap in that November, so we got multiple rows. All right. So that's one of the more powerful techniques you can use these row numbers for. Now, something else I want to show you is by default, the window frame is actually fixed. So for the other functions that I showed you, you actually have to put a, you can only have one number in the window frame. You can't dynamically change it in your query. But for lag and lead, you actually can. And so here's what I'm going to do. What I want is for each month, or for each row, I want the value on the first day of next month. That's an interesting problem to solve. And here's how I'm going to solve it. I'm going to use both a row number and the lead function. And what I'm going to do is calculate a row number partitioned by product ID and month and ordered by transaction ID descending. Okay? And what this is going to tell me is the number of rows until next month. So when I run this, here is, so it's backward. So actually, we have to look starting down here. So here's September, right? And so if I'm on September 5th, there's four rows until whatever the next month is. And if I'm on September 12th, there's only three rows until next month. And if I'm on the 16th, there's only two rows. And I'm on the 26th, there's only one row. And so on and so forth. And all of the months have their own counter. And now if I want to look forward to the next month, I have to look forward that many rows. So now I can take this row number, if I want the value on the first of the next month, and this is one of the more powerful things you can do if you really need this kind of flexibility, and I can plug it in to that optional second parameter. So now this says, give me the actual cost and look forward however many rows there are until next month. And now for each row, logically, it's going to do that work and look forward that many rows and give me that value on the first of next month. And so that's one of the things you can do that is really quite powerful and allows us to create very, very flexible solutions by using lag and lead. And doing the same thing in T-SQL prior to the existence of these functions would be incredibly, incredibly complex. You probably have to use, I don't know, if you wanted to perform well, you'd probably have to start putting your data into temp tables and massaging it, indexing it, and doing all kinds of things. As you can see here, that ran in 0 seconds. Almost instantaneous, and it just works. So it's very, very nice. Any questions on that? The query plan, yes. So here's the query plan. And so we scan the transaction history table, sort the data. That sort is for calculating of the row number. That's the segment and sequence project. Then sort the data again, and the reason is that our window frame is dynamic on there. So it sorts again, and then puts the data into the window spool, which once again is what's doing all the work here. All right. So that's lag and lead. Okay. Let's take a look at one other aggregate, which is a moving average of the last quarter's performance. As I said, I think moving average is another one of these really interesting examples that has a lot of business value. Here, once again, I'm going to prepare the data by grouping on product ID and the end of the month. I'm going to calculate my sum. And we're going to calculate a moving average over the last quarter. So once again, the current row is an actual row. So it's only two rows preceding plus the current row. We want 3 months in each moving average if it's the prior quarter, right? And that's simple enough. Once again, our product 366, I don't have to scroll down to show you, has a gap. So what do we have to do? What do you want to do? Fix it. If we want last quarter, we can't have a gap, right? So we have to do something about it. So let's, if we have three periods that are non-consecutive, so we actually have three prior periods, this is the business rule I've created here. If I have only two prior periods, I'm going to send it back. I'm going to assume it's a new product or something, and maybe we didn't have any data, so it's fine. But if we have three periods, but they're non-consecutive, then I'm going to send back a null so that the application knows that something's missing. And here's how I'm going to do it. So we're going to take the moving average, which again uses the average function, looking back two periods. Then I'm going to count the rows with the same window frame. That's going to tell me how many consecutive periods that I have. And then I'm going to take the first value. So now you can see how these are all working together in some form of harmony. I'm going to take the first value, which will give me the first month in the frame. And now all I have to do is plug that into a case expression. If I have fewer than three rows in my frame, that means it's a new product or something. I want to send it back. If I have exactly 2 months between the first month in my frame and my transaction month, that's cool. So if either of those are the case, I'm good to go. Otherwise, send back a null. And so you can see how I can apply all of these together and create fairly complex business rules in my query. Whether or not you want fairly complex business rules in your query is another discussion for another time. But I'll turn on the actual query plan. We run that, see that worked. If I go down to my 366 once again, 366, where are you? We can see we started passing back a couple of nulls because we didn't have any data. We didn't have enough data. It doesn't make sense to report on prior quarter when it's actually prior rows. And my execution plan is kind of interesting. What we're going to see is this is preparation of the data in this section. Over here, we have one sort and one window spool for all that work. So because they all had the exact same frame at the exact same level of the query and there was nothing dynamic, was able to reuse that window spool. And I can apply as many of these functions as I want, and it'll just keep reusing that window spool for that frame over and over and over. So good stuff there. Any questions on that? All right, so let's finish with a discussion on performance and getting the most out of these things. So I'm going to go into AdventureWorks, and we're going to talk about indexing first. So I'm going to prepare a temp table called BTH. I'm going to throw rows from my big transaction history table. This is, again, for those of you who weren't there yesterday, where I mentioned this before, this is a blown-up version of the transaction history table that ships with the AdventureWorks database. Instead of having 100,000 transactions, it has 30 million. So I'm going to put in the transactions for products 1001 through 5001. And I'm going to turn on actual query plan. Oops. And now let's just do a running sum, and let's take it from that temp table for where the quantity is greater than zero. We want a sum of stuff that we actually sold. And that takes a few seconds. I think it takes 8 seconds. Okay, so that's like an 8-second query. And what we can see is that SQL Server is telling us, if we look at this plan, that it believes that the sort is rather expensive. Now notice it's not giving us any hints on how to solve it. Now if it had an idea of what it thought we should do, the query optimizer, I should say, rather than SQL Server, if the query optimizer thought we should create an index, it would give us maybe a little index hint. But I think we can create an index to enhance this a little bit, maybe. Let's find out. And what we want to do is create an index using the POC. methodology. Remember I mentioned the O or the P and the O before? So P is partitioning, O is ordering, C is covering. If you want to optimize window functions, it's P, O, and C. So here I'm creating an index on product ID because that's what I'm partitioning on. Partition by product ID, order by transaction ID. So P, product ID, O, transaction ID, covering. I want my index to include all of the other columns that it references so that we don't have to have a clustered lookup or a RID lookup or something in there. So I'm going to include my transaction date, actual cost, and quantity. And now I have my POC index. Let me create that. It's there. Let's try again and see what happens. See if it'll use my index. Now the last query took 8 seconds, and this one I actually got a tiny bit slower. It took 9 seconds. I expected it to be the same, but it actually got a tiny bit slower. Maybe it was on the edge before. Actually took 9 seconds. Now, we lost our sort, which SQL Server was telling us before was the most expensive thing in the plan, but it's still running slowly. Why is that? Well, we're filtering, obviously, a lot of rows on quantity. And so we're touching a lot of extra rows in the index scan. So in this index scan over here, we're touching a lot of rows that are getting filtered out on behalf of that quantity predicate. So what we want to do if we want to speed up this plan is not touch those rows. Now, interestingly, SQL Server is now telling us, guess what? If you create this index, you're going to be able to do a lot better. Let me right-click and click Missing Index Details and see what index SQL Server is after. SQL Server wants an index, or I should say the Query Optimizer. I need to stop calling it SQL Server in general. The Query Optimizer would like an index on quantity and then covering all of the rest of the columns in the table. And I'm going to extend that metaphor a tiny bit. So if my other one, the index that was used here is called IPOC, Index Partitioning Ordering Covering. Let's extend it and let's call it FPOC, Filtering Partitioning Ordering Covering. So I'm going to create my FPOC index, which is on quantity, just like the Query Optimizer wants, product ID and transaction ID. And then I'm going to cover my transaction date and my actual cost. I've just created that. Now, this is interesting. I did effectively what I was asked to do by the Query Optimizer. When I run this query, it still takes 9 seconds. The suggestion that I create an index is gone, but it didn't use the index. The index is still IPOC. It didn't even use the new index that I created for it to set. It just wanted it there just to feel comfortable, apparently. It didn't like the index. So what am I supposed to do? Now, why didn't it use the index? Why isn't this a good index? If I was ordering on quantity and then product ID and then transaction ID, that would be a good index. But if you think about it, once you filter on the quantity, you don't know if you're still ordered on the product ID or transaction ID. Like if you scan the quantities, that's how SQL Server would filter on that index, it doesn't know whether it's still ordered on product ID or transaction ID. So as it turns out, this index, the way that the query is written, is useless. So we need to do something else. So let's think of a new way to write the query, a completely different way. Those of you who were in my session yesterday may know where I'm going already. What I'm going to do is take all of the product IDs out of the table, and I'm going to put them into a temp table, distinct. So select distinct product ID into pound products from BTH. I just ran that. Now I have a temp table called pound products that has one row per product ID. And now, instead of writing the query as it was before, now let's look at the query again. The query filters on quantity, but the window function, which is really where all the cost is going, is run logically once per product ID, right? Because it's partitioned on product ID. So instead of logically running it once per product ID, what I want to do is make it physically run once per product ID. So I have my temp table, and I'm going to rewrite the query using cross-apply. And what cross-apply does is logically takes whatever's in the outer query and logically runs the inner query once per outer query. Now, I keep saying logically because there's lots and lots of different ways that it could be optimized by the Query Optimizer, but as it turns out, most of the time, it will physically do the same thing. So this query says, start with your products table. I could actually take the where clause off. It's redundant. It's from a prior version of this demo. Start with the products table. Correlate on product ID, so grab rows from the temp table once per product ID. Filter on the quantity. This will give us the same set of rows, logically, as we had before. And run the sum. Notice I've taken the partition by off of the sum because now that partition by is implicit because the derived table on behalf of cross-apply is correlated on the outer products temp table. And when I run this, now the last query took, 9 seconds, something like that? Let's run this one. And I have cut 50% of the time, well, 33% of the time off the query. We've gone from 9 seconds to 6 seconds. Not too bad. And let's go and look at the query plan. And what we can see is that instead of having one kind of long straight query plan, we run one product ID at a time into a nested loop. For each product ID, we go back to the temp table, grab rows just for that product, segment them, run them through the window spool, and out. So this turns out to be a much more efficient way to run things. If we had a sort, we could also reduce the sort cost in here. It's not the most efficient way, though. Do you notice anything missing from my sum here that we talked about earlier? Rows, excellent. I'm glad you all were paying some attention. Rows, unbounded proceeding. Prior version of the query, 6 seconds. As soon as I add a row frame, now the row frame should be implicit because I'm ordering on the primary key effectively, but you know, SQL Server just doesn't do that for me. As soon as I add the row mode, we go from 6 seconds down to 1 second. That's how you speed these things up. Row mode plus this pattern. If I did rows mode without this pattern, it would still be 3 or 4 seconds. I like 1 second better than 3 or 4 seconds. I don't know about you. So that's that. That's how you can really, really make these things faster, really make them fly, give your users back the data that they need using slightly simpler queries than before, much faster than before. And I'm going to show you one final example, which is something cool I came up with just recently. Here's a function, or here's a query, I should say, that uses max partitioned by product ID. And what it does is finds the, so it goes out to big transaction history for products 1001 through 8001 with an actual cost greater than zero, stuff we actually sold, and it finds the max actual cost per product. Maybe I want to do some division or something, or calculate for each transaction whether we sold it within a certain range of the maximum amount for which we've ever sold the product. I don't know. You can think of various business rules. In this case, I want all of the sales where they were within 5% of the actual cost. That's my fake business requirement here. And what we can see with max, now this one was a partitioned but not ordered max. And what we can see, this was added in SQL Server 2005. And in SQL Server 2005, the way that they implemented these was with a spool. This is an old style table spool, not a window spool. So it's an old style table spool, and all the rows are put in the spool. And then the spool is scanned twice inside a loop here. So that means the rows go into tempdb, and then they're read out of tempdb once, and then they're read out of tempdb a second time. And the reason for this is on the first run, they're read out and aggregated, and whatever max value I come up with is then applied to the rows as they're read from this innermost spool on that second pass. And that was fine in SQL Server 2005, but in SQL Server 2012, actually I'm demoing on SQL Server 2014 here, they just left that optimization in place. They left that kind of query plan in place, even though in the interim, the SQL Server team implemented the window spool. So wouldn't it be nice to take advantage of that window spool and hopefully get a better query plan? Well, that plan took 3 seconds to run. Let's remember that. Now let's think about max, and let's think about it in terms of ordering. If I want to look backward, and I want to find the max value, what I need is to have the max value logically, if you will, behind me the whole time. And then I can use the window frame that I want, or then I can use, sorry, the window spool and order it. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to partition by product ID, we're going to order by actual cost descending, and we're going to look back at all the preceding rows. Because we're ordering by actual cost descending, the maximum actual cost is always going to be the first row. As we look back and find the max actual cost, looking backwards, it's never going to change. This query, because it uses order by, will now use the window spool. And when I run this, instead of 3 seconds, I get two. Well, usually it runs in one, but it took two that time. And notice our spool is gone, and the query is doing a lot less work. We had the sort before, so that wasn't added in. We're just about out of time, so let me just finish up here. So I think hopefully you've seen that you can make your complex T-SQL queries a lot simpler. If you want great performance, that's up to you, not up to SQL Server yet. So hopefully someday the optimizer team will improve that a little bit. Be careful with the range mode, and be creative, and most of all, have fun. I think SQL and T-SQL and performance tuning and all this stuff is very satisfying and a fun use of your time. I don't have any resources, but what I would love you to do, if you would take a couple of seconds, is win an Xbox One by completing the evaluation. Thank you for joining me. Have a great rest of the conference.